tapes. So they're all Labyrinth covers.
And it was just a coincidence that you knew her. Would you repeat that story?
Oh. Well, at one time,
I
worked at a sewing factory.
Oh boy! What were you sewing in your sewing factory?
Oh, I was sewing little girls' dresses.
Little Polly Flinders kind of dresses.
Cinderella frocks.
Oh, Cinderella frocks.
Cinderella
I've always
frocks.
Loved those things.
And? And, well, I just knew girls by their first names, you know, that we would meet. And there was a union meeting that they urged all of us to go to, and I didn't want to go. And so I went at the last minute and went in late. And another girl came in that I knew as Pat, came in late, and so we sat together in the back because neither of us had wanted to go. Well, that morning we had had a little, we had just gotten a little 45 record of Molly Darlin, and she had, and I had taken some into the factory, and at noon probably she bought one along with others, you know, and she mentioned, "I bought one of your little Molly Darlin records," said, "and I can't wait to get home to play it," said, "my mother and father-in-law used to play that kind of music." And I said, "well, what is your last name, Pat?" And she said, "Haley." And I said, "you don't mean Ed Haley?" And she said, "yeah, that was my father-in-law." So, due to a story that came out the next day, we were had to be interviewed at a newspaper. JP had gotten there ahead of us, and he didn't know any of this, and I didn't know what he had told the interviewer. And the story in the Ashland paper came out, started out with that he had learned a lot of his fiddle tunes from Ed Haley. So Pat was real enthused, and she told her husband about, you know, and he was real enthused, and he said, and then they came out here, and he listened to JP play, and he said he played more like his dad than anybody had ever heard. And then he was telling us about having all of these home recordings that his father had done. He had them wrapped in onion skin and paper, you know, to preserve them so they wouldn't be scratched. And, you know, we said we'd like to hear them, and he said he had never allowed them out of the house. And he didn't, he was afraid that somebody would try to commercialize off of them, or that they would make fun of his father because he had been blind and that he did drink a lot and various things, you know, and that they had taken very good care of their children, and he didn't want anybody making fun of them. And so he just kept them there. Well, eventually, he didn't have any way to play them for us to hear them, so he did bring a few of them out to our house so that we could hear them. Well, later we were making this album for Rounder Records, and they came here to our house to make it. And during all the our talk and everything, you know, well, Ed Haley's name came up because he had been heard of. Every fiddler in the in the eastern United States practically had heard Ed Haley at one time or another, and had been influenced in some way by his fiddling. Clark Kessinger being one of them, and Georgia Slim, that a lot of people had heard of, been another one. And so his name was well known. And anyhow, I called Larry, and after about an hour's talking to him, he agreed to meet for Mark to come in and hear the records. And he still was afraid of the commercializing and so forth. Well, Mark was a very good fella, and talked him into letting him make some kind of arrangements for them to be recorded. And so eventually he made arrangements with Alan Jabour in the Library of Congress. And so Larry would not agree for them to be out of his hands, so they flew him and his son along with the records to Washington, and they recorded them for the Library of Congress. They used filters and so forth to try to take out scratches. You know, they were very poor quality. Some of them were worn quite a bit. And anyhow, from those, they did allow Rounder to make one album from them, and then the rest of them are in the Library of Congress.
That's an amazing story. That it would have, the chances of Alan Jabour and the other people that are working on that Library of Congress collection, the chances of them locating Ed Haley's descendants and being able to work with them, that's so rare. I mean, it's just pure happenstance that you were there and you said, your last name is what? I think that's a marvelous story.
All due to a little 45 recording. If she hadn't bought that recording, I might never have known.
You know, I've heard the Brandywine record of you and JP singing Brent Molly Darling, and I have worked at singing that as I'm going along in the car. I have made a cassette off of that album, and we play it in the car a lot. Your harmony is so close on that I can't tell whether you're singing above JP or below JP. Your voices blend. Part of the time you're above him in the harmony, and then part of the time you're under him. How long have you worked at that song? You did it like that the very first time you sang it, didn't you?
Probably. Because we can go a year and not sing it and sing it the same. We just sing it the same way. It just comes out that way. We used to do a little radio program years ago, and that's when we started singing. We had to come up with something every week in harmony, and that's the one thing since the radio program has gone by the wayside, that's one of about three songs that we've retained.
The rest of them you're tired of, or you...
We've just forgotten them because we didn't sing together that much. JP doesn't particularly like to sing, and I think we do have good harmony. But
you have an amazing blend. I think it's fortunate that your voices blend. Maybe some of that is talking to, and you have a good ear, and you naturally... You hear that voice daily, you know.
Well,
I think that's some of it.
Yeah. Well, and I think another thing is, see, we can't sing lead in the same key. What is, like if he would sing something, a lead in, I'm trying to think of something, say in A, I would probably have to do that in E.
Hmm.
So his voice... is in a much higher range or lower, every which way you want to go.
Way you are.
Yeah. I mean, if I would sing along with him, then I have to sing it real high to be, I don't know anything about music. Neither of us know music at all. We just know what comes out. But I think that's another reason for the blend. So I can sing the harmony, see, at a lower, it's usually lower than his, if you don't, as a general rule. No, I think sometimes, you're right, it does go.
It depends on who's singing lead, which way it's going to work out.
Well, he sings the lead. I don't know of anything that he doesn't sing the lead on that we do.
But part of the time you're above him, and then sometimes you come in under him, it makes for a marvelous listening.
Mm-hmm.
I said, I could learn that. It's complicated to try to pick that out. To do what you're doing.
Well, we just do what comes naturally. we can't do it on all songs. I mean, there are songs that we just can't sing together. I guess it's true for everybody, though.
Well, I think the trick is that you know when you're not doing the song up to your expectations.
Yeah.
There are a lot of people who sing together and they go ahead and do them anyway.
Yeah, I know, I think
that's the trick, is that the ones that you do, that you do play out, are the ones that you feel that you like the best. And that that ear is what a lot of people you get them and they think they're doing a great job and they're doing their very best, but it's some of that is an inability to know what is your best work, and maybe you've weeded out those other old songs that you had to do when you were under a pressure of a weekly radio program.
Mm-hmm.
And that is very different.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
From the kind of performing that you're doing now.
Mm-hmm. Oh yes, in fact we did some things that we wouldn't do now, you know, that, and we did some that I want to revive.
you could. Yeah. What radio station was it?
Grayson, WGOH, and also WTCR, Ashley.
We
did. That was how we didn't, JP played from the time he was 8. Of course, he can tell you all about that. And I learned when I was about 13, across the road, I had an old guitar that had been left at my grandmother's by a friend out of Pennsylvania. And I got it, and I would go across the road where they would play at night sometimes, you know, and come back. I'd watch where they put their fingers and come back and and keep putting mine there until I learned the chords. And so I played a little in high school around, you know, and then he played various places. He played once with Roy Acuff when he came through, or played for him. Now,
is that right?
Yeah, and when he came through Grayson once. But anyhow, then after we got married, we played around a few little high schools. And when our son was just a few weeks old, a few months old, rather, we played at the Mount Laurel Festival at Levi Jackson State Park, but we didn't know what it was. They had heard us over at the Hyden High School and asked us to come down and play, and we went down and played, and right after we played, the governor got up and spoke.
You could have introduced the governor, if you know. No.
I think that threw us into a state of shock because we didn't play anymore for 14 years.
Is that right? For 14 years without playing?
That's right. Maybe
that
once
surprises me because I have seen you and been aware of your performances ever since I became aware that this kind of music existed. There was a period of time when I was growing up that all I heard, I'm from Texas.
Yeah.
I grew up north of Amarillo. And what we heard was Bob Wills or Bob Wills imitators.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a constant diet of that in the morning when we woke up.
I loved Bob Wills.
Oh, I do too. And I wasn't aware of different fiddle styles because when you just hear one kind, you think that's fiddle music.
Yeah.
And that to me was the definition of fiddle music.
Mm-hmm.
And my grandfather played in western Oklahoma, and I knew he didn't play Bob Wills style, but I was such a small kid and I was kind of going off in a fog, and when we got to Tennessee I realized there is some neat fiddle music, and then that's when I became aware of your festival in 1977 and 78 when you had it at Greenbow, and I just, this is the most marvelous stuff I've ever seen, I've ever heard. All I wanted to do was learn all the tunes, and I've never really wanted to be a contest fiddler.
Yeah.
Has JP ever played contest style?
He's played in contests, but he's not a contest fiddler.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, that's what this was this past weekend, you know. And he has won Fiddler of the Festival down there twice. But he hasn't really tried anymore. He doesn't really do that well under pressure. And I just don't, as far as I'm concerned, I wish he never would enter another contest. And the only reason we do that is we're getting free.
It makes a world of difference,
yeah,
doesn't it?
Well, and we like those people so well. They come up to our festival every year, the people that run that, Harper, Van Hoy, and Wansey.
Mm-hmm.
And they come up every year, and so we go down there. We've just become real good friends, and so that's... And they really expect him to enter, you know, when he goes, and... And, of course, he does, you know. He likes, well, he kind of likes to do it, but he's just not a contest fiddler.
That's part of the drawing card
is
people expect.
And, you know, you really should be talking to him because he'll be wanting to go.
Oh, well, I was hoping we could come back next week sometime.
Oh, well, yeah, okay. Yeah, that's, I just thought, well, you know, if you're going to spend so much time talking, it should be his. No, I was thinking about, rather than talking to me, you should be talking to him. You could talk to me after he left.
Oh, I could, couldn't I?
Yeah.
Well,
but if you want to come back, well.
I wanted to get that story about Ed Haley while we were on it.
Yeah.
And if we didn't do it right then, it might not happen again.
Well, that's true. That's exactly
you know how
happened.
That is.
Yes.
So, you know,
well, that was all I was. Coming out here and drinking my morning coffee, I'll sit in there and watch television or something, and then later in the day I think, well, why didn't I go out there and sit and watch the birds or whatever? You know, I'll get around to it.
I'm real conscious of the birds. There was
well,
one
I
that
love
was real
birds,
busy.
You know? Well, I keep some feed up there. I'm about out of it now just to keep the birds coming in all the time. But of course, we have a lot of trees around that are going to be around.
Now, have you trained the birds so they don't eat the garden things that you don't want them to
well,
eat? Are these smart birds?
They don't eat the garden things anyhow. They would only eat bugs. They're good. So I don't keep a lot of feed to keep them from filling up on the feed and not getting the bugs. I mean, the birds are valuable for that.
What was it you were putting up last summer? I know JP came down to Moorhead and you were putting up something. Was it strawberries or
no,
whatever?
No, I think it was
in?
Was it this time of the year, in June?
It was the last of June.
I don't know. Is that when the cherries were ripe?
It was cherries.
Cherries? Yeah, that was.
Did you were up to your elbows in cherries?
I was so mad at him. I didn't want any cherries. They had a cherry tree over there. Well, I'll tell you how I got rid of the cherry tree. Well, actually, a storm had caused it to break. And it was loaded, just literally loaded with cherries. And it one thing broke off. Well, did you ever pick cherries?
Yeah.
They're horrible. Yeah, I mean, it takes you forever. And we don't use them. I'd rather go buy a can of cherry pie filling. You know, not that, it's just that we don't use things like we used to. You know, used to I did all that stuff. And I'm still doing it, unfortunately. But when I was gone one day, he picked all, a huge amount, just picked them. And he said, if you won't do them, I'll do them. See, I knew that he wouldn't. I said, okay, you know, if you think you can do them. Well, then it changed to, well, I'll help you do them. I thought, well, that's something. So he started on them on Friday evening. He came over there on Saturday, right?
Mm-hmm.
Friday evening he started. Well, after he got about a quart done, he laid down and went to sleep.
It was tedious, isn't it?
Those were all, I mean, tedious. It took him forever to do that quart. So there was all those cherries picked. And they had to be, you know, and I can't throw anything out. I just can't. Well, I had read a little hint someplace. Well, I put it, give him the same thing, how to pit them. Just use an ordinary paper clip. I mean, you just as fast as you can pick them up, you can pit them with that paper clip. But you got to pick up a lot of cherries.
Do it.
But, and that's what I used, and you know, that juice is everywhere, you know, but that was the easiest thing I'd found. So I had to finish all those cherries. I worked on that night, and then the next day, I worked on them all day to get all those cherries. Well, we got the cherry tree cut down, all of it. He was going to leave part of it, but it's all gone.
No more cherries.
I've got enough cherries to last for the next 3 or 4 years.
That tree had a good year. We had a plum tree in Texas. We lived at that house for 5 years. For the first 4 summers, we would get maybe just a large mixing bowl size of those plums. They were pretty, pretty red, round plums. But just a little, you know, bowl this size, and that would be all. The last summer I was there, we got bushels off of that tree. You go out there every afternoon for a week and a half, and I could pick up a half bush basket. We did plums. At first, I did every plum the first 2 days that I worked on this project. And I was making it into jam right then. And then I discovered that some of these plums are not as good as the other plums. So I started sorting the plums, and I would only do the choicest plums. Finally, I got to where I couldn't buy any more sugar. I couldn't put up any more. So I started just freezing the plum stuff. I had plums splashed all over the kitchen. It was the biggest mess I've ever seen because we put it down in this thing. Go around.
Right,
I was trying to teach other people. I was trying to invite friends over to help me.
Well,
it's a project.
Yeah. Well,
doing the cherries is a project.
Yeah. Well, it's the pitting the cherries that I. But I love to pick blackberries. Of course, not now, but earlier in life. I think I could have picked blackberries for a living. Briars and bushes and all. I love to do it. And so I always make jelly and jam. And I take most of the seeds out with the... I have blackberries everywhere. So, but it's worth it. I like that.
Oh, and that's a great stuff.
My problem is I end up giving a lot of it away, and then I think, well, they weren't out there getting those chiggers and getting those arms scratched up. What am I getting?
Those chiggers. I can tell you some chigger stories that you would be envious. You would wish that you were with me.
There's no story that can top the chigger holler story of the Fraley Family Mountain Music Festival the year before you came. I mean, that is still going the rounds everywhere.
You mean all of these people came into your
Everybody
festival?
Everybody got chiggers. Some of them ended up in emergency rooms.
Now, this is the stuff that doesn't get in the newspaper,
story,
that, does it?
It got in Henry Fiddler's newsletter.
Oh, it did.
And it also got in the Herald Dispatch because Charlie Bowen was one of them, one of the reporters that ended up in the emergency room.
Well, you know, artists say you have to suffer for your art, right?
But the funniest thing of all of it was that this, I got this call from Huntington about a month after the festival. And this lady, I don't think she identified herself. Or if she did, the name passed over me, you know, not knowing who she was. And she mentioned that she had really enjoyed the festival. She wanted to tell me she had really enjoyed the festival. They had been down there and since everybody had gotten chiggers, and that's all I had heard about, I said, well, before you say anything else, tell me, did you get any chiggers? She said, is that what they were? She said, there was 11 of us. Said some of our friends came down from Michigan, and there was 11 of us, and said, and see, it was the first year we'd had it at Greenbow. We used to have it at Carter Caves. And she said, we thought it was going to be at Carter Cave, so we had reserved a cabin. And then when we found it was switched to Greenbow, we tried to get rooms down there, and we couldn't get them. So we decided rather than that we would just stay at Carter Caves in her cabin and drive back and forth. She said, and we all got this, ever what it was, and I had to go into the emergency room, or maybe her and a couple more, and the emergency room doctor didn't know what it was. And he thought that they had probably picked up something in this cabin at Carter Caves. So they called Carter Caves, and they renovated that cabin. Well, it was the next year after the next festival that I went up to Huntington, and I was looking for a piece of unfinished furniture, some bookcases or something. And there's a place way up in the upper end of Huntington, Ritter Furniture, that has unfinished furniture. And I went up there, and I couldn't find what I wanted, but they had a lounge chair that I wanted, just a cot, fold-up cot. And so I bought it, wrote him a check for him. He came back up. He said, how was the festival this year? So I thought, well, you know, he's recognized the name on the check, you know, maybe from the paper or something. And I said, oh, it was just fine, you know. I said, it rained. It did rain, you know, it was the year it rains much. And I said, it was, except for that, you know, it was a pretty good festival. And he said, well, my wife and children went down, said, and they enjoyed it, said, and some friends from Michigan. He clicked, and I said, say, did your wife happen to call me last year? He said, yes, she did. So it was the people, the woman that got the chiggers, had the cabin renovated. And I'd gone in that store several times. I had no idea they'd come down there, you know.
You've been doing that festival 15 years.
Be 15 this year.
Whoa. That the time that we came up from Knoxville, that's quite a little drive for us. We had two little kids with us, and it was the most enjoyable festival that we'd been to that year. And you know who was here? That they were much closer to us, just over there from Canton, North Carolina, was Liz and Lynn Shaw. Yeah. We had never seen them before. And
I
we were
this past weekend.
So impressed. How are they doing?
They're doing fine. They have a little 2-year-old named Evan.
They have
they
a
camped
baby.
Right next to us.
Oh. Is it a boy or girl?
Boy.
Oh, 2-year-old boy. That'd be something, wouldn't it? You know, last year when JP came over to Moorhead to play on the arts, and when you were doing the cherry, that's the first time that I've seen him perform without you.
Well, he went over because Roger Lewis asked him to come. See, Roger comes to our festival all the time, you know, for free. So he just went because Roger had asked us to come, and he just hated, you know, not to go. So he went over because Roger asked him.
Well, I thought it was interesting, and you probably don't know this because you weren't there unless JP came home and reported, and he might not mention it because it would have been a complaint kind of thing. He may not have said it, but JP started into, I'm not sure what tune he started playing. It was a tune that I think most guitar players could follow, but he got into about the second time through the A part, and he quit. That the guitar player wasn't playing it like he's used to hearing.
hearing it played, and he quit and said, we'll do another tune here. And then he conversed a little with the guitar player and discovered what he was going to be able to play and what he didn't. But I thought it was interesting that instead of pressing on through the tune in a less than satisfactory rendition of what it was. It may have been Red Apple Rag. Is that fairly... It's not real standard-like, I don't know.
No, but it's easy. Three chords,
well, what's easy for you might not be easy for other people.
Well, I'm always amazed at some of these really good guitar players that knows all... See, I don't know very many chords at all. And I'm always amazed at so many of that knows all these, that can't find these little simple chords that go with some of the fiddle tunes. I see this all the time.
The most awful experiences I have had have been at informal get-togethers, a party or something, and someone will say, oh, bring your fiddle. And I'll get there with my fiddle, and someone will have a guitar, and maybe they've been listening to hard rock music, and that's the kind of guitar music they like, and they'll try to follow and play back up to it. It's traumatic because they're not hearing, as you say, the simple little chord. They're not hearing the chord changes, and they're working it a whole lot harder than it is. And it's hard for me to say, you're not even beginning to do what I want you to do. And I've demonstrated, tried to take a guitar and hum the fiddle tune, doodle 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 doodle, doodle, and show them what to do, and they still can't do it. I mean, I think it's a matter of either hearing it at some point or not hearing it.
Well, I am not a good guitar player. I mean, I can do rhythm, that's it. But I don't know, I can't follow the fancy waltzes and things, and I'd love to know them. It's not that I don't want to. I just don't have the capabilities of learning a lot of these. I've learned what I know. I can add a chord every now and then, learn a new one, but some of them I know where to put, and some I just don't know where to put them. You know, so if I drop trying to learn that chord, because, you know, if I don't know where to put it, why should I know it?
I can understand that.
But now, when it comes to most fiddle tunes, I can hear the changes.
I've seen you play effortlessly.
Well, I can follow different fiddle players. It don't have to be just JP. You know, I can hear the chord changes. Sometimes I might miss them the first couple of times through, you know, but I'll hear it. I know it's there someplace. And like I say, I'm not real good at that. I don't mean that, and there's a lot that I can't find, but I mean on simple ones. And that's why it's kind of amazing that these good guitar players don't hear those changes, you know. But I felt good this weekend. You know Mike Seeger? Have you heard of Mike Seeger?
Yes, I've seen Mike Seeger when I'm in Knoxville. He played... laid out a bunch of instruments and just kind of went from instrument to instrument. Took him about 2 hours.
We were playing, and I saw him sitting out front. We know him, you know, and we've been around lots of places where he was, and he's introduced us a lot of times too. Anyhow, I went down and sat down by him. He'd sent us the tape, and I never had wrote to thank him for it, and went down to tell him we had gotten it, you know. But anyhow, he's real observant of all this, and I said it was the best compliment I'd received. He said, and there'd been a whole lot of fiddle players on there. He said, of all the guitar players, said you've had the best rhythm of anybody that's been on there. And you know, and for Mike Seeger never says anything like that. He never commits himself. So, boy, I couldn't hardly sit there.
That is right, though. He doesn't make judgmental statements.
But I didn't tell JP what else he said. He said, has JP been playing any? I said, well, you know, some, not much. He said, you've been playing more than he has, haven't you? And I said, well, no, not really. He's played more than I have. Somehow he said it sounded as though, I didn't say it just the way he did, but sounded as though he thought I had been practicing, but JP hadn't. And I hadn't had my guitar out of the case. It's March, 1st of March. So I felt real good about that.
You know, one thing.
I thought, now if I did practice, what could I do?
But one thing I like about when I see you and JP perform is that you're relaxed. I've never seen you look that you're concentrating on the audience, that you do want to do things that you think they'll enjoy on stage. But I like it whenever you turn to each other and say, what do you want to do?
Well, we used to make out a program. I used to have a program made out. And every, when we get up there, JP would decide he wasn't going to play that. That he either couldn't
remember
it.
What we like is cooperation.
Yeah,
isn't it?
They can remember it, or he just didn't want to play. He wanted to play something else. So when I said something about that, well, he came up with that and said, I guess he thought that you I didn't tell him anything. It was so funny that he came out with the very thing that I wasn't going to tell him.
I'm sure you are aware of this, but when we first met you, I had no idea that you had been to Washington, D.C., that you had been part of this, that you had played for the Smithsonian, that you've been part of this larger national folk festival. I didn't know that you'd gone to Alaska or that you were going to El Paso. I mean, these are, whoa.
Here's my petticoat hanging.
You look like you're ready to preach. Wow.
Where I'm going, I sure don't like to go.
That's probably the last time you see him like that. You ought to take his picture.
We need a photograph now. We'll get him down. That's a pretty suit. Looks nice with his hair, doesn't it?
Have fun. That was a bad thing to say. He will. Even if Joe, you know how these men are, JP can't keep telling jokes and tales and tell all tale tales.
How do we arrange? We can't tell David ahead of time because he'll make such a marvelous audience. How do we arrange to let JP lead us into the musky story about the walnut? You heard that story?
No.
Oh, well, I'll see if I can lead him into it. It's a marvelous story.
Into the what?
Now, see, last summer, I'll tell you folks. I'll tell you just a little bit. It's his story. Last summer, JP saw that he had some academics, very vulnerable academics, cornered. So you weren't here. He stopped at our house. It's on the way home on US 60 there. And Gene wanted JP Fraley to stop and fiddle on our porch so badly. It was just a, you're probably aware, but you may not be aware that you have been our idols for about 8 years. Mm-hmm. And I know,
idols with feet of clay.
But that it was really important to us to see JP sitting on our front porch in the porch swing fiddling. And it was such an occasion that JP was going to have time to stop. I didn't know at the time that if he came on home, he would have to help with the cherries. Oh, yeah. we got to put this in the proper perspective. But let's see, I was there, Gene was there, Ron Dobler, Jeannie Dobler, you know them, mm-hmm. Our children, and of course, whatever JP did, we just all ears, just ready to listen or visit or whatever he wanted to do. And he discovered, Gene, my husband, brought up the idea that he'd fish. Gene was real anxious to be here in Kentucky because he was good fishing. JP started off on the most marvelous fish story you've ever heard. And you get burned. So you laugh at the wrong time and then you realize the story folds back on itself. Oh, it was marvelous. So when you say tell stories, you mean serious storytelling here. This is not small-time storytelling.
They got in the storytelling thing down at the World's Fair. They had a workshop. They had a little time period there. They didn't know what to do, so they decided to have a storytelling thing. So they got JP and, goodness, I can't remember the other people's names now. Albert, is his name Mash or Hash? Was with White Top Mountain. He died, but anyhow, he was a tall tale. Ever what? Storyteller. But there was, maybe five or six of them. And I sat back on the back bench. It was our last day, and I'd gone in and done all the business up. JP never does any of that stuff, you know. And come back and sat down there, and there's some women sitting over by me. And this Albert Nash, he really told some tall stories. And of course, JP, he got started. These women over by me, one of them said, JP was telling, said, I believe that's the best one. I believe that he tells the tallest story. And I looked around and I said, how would you like to have to live with some of us? She said, you mean you have to live with that? Oh, I tell you, that it was fun. They had more fun with that. It was impromptu, not planned, you know, and that made it better.
If we can somehow get planned spontaneity, if we can somehow do that, and it's hard to get, it doesn't happen very often.
Yeah.
It really doesn't. And I think that's one thing about y'all's performing is that there is a spontaneous air when you turn around and say, well, what do you want to play now? And I like that.
It's not just an air, it's a reality.
Yeah. The problem is, if I turn around and do it, we look unprepared. But y'all don't look that way.
I always have something in my mind to do if he can't think of anything. While we're, in fact, you know, I'm known for forgetting words in songs.
Are you?
Yes. And usually the reason I have forgotten the words is because I'm trying to think ahead to what JP can play or to what I, because a lot of times he is just a blank. He can think of tunes one after another when we're jamming, but not when you say play something.
Oh, I've gone blank numerous times and can't think of the tune. Sometimes I think it's with a key change that we've been playing in D for a little while and then we need to be in A and I can't hear it in my mind. It might just be that I'm senile. I don't know.
And he likes to go opposite to what I say or think. So if I suggest something, well, then that'll bring something immediately to his mind. Not what I suggested, but something else.
And you really don't care, do you?
No, I just want him to think of something to play. There are times that I keep him from playing, like Orange Blossom Special or something, because it would... See, JP plays what he wants to play, and I try to read the audience, think about what they're enjoying or what they would like, and so if when he wants to do Orange Blossom Special, which isn't one of our usual numbers, and it's more bluegrassy, and I feel like that the audience would like, I like for him to save that till last.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if he wants to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Because he builds up right in the middle and then it's a letdown, you know.
I think that is one of the hardest things to try to guess, and it really is a guessing game, at what the audience is going to like the most. And if you're going to play for an hour, you want to have a good close out.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And boy, that has been a real trick for us. And we've been trying to guess now for about... We really didn't start doing any performing until like 1978, right at the tail end there before we moved to Texas. And it was great in Texas because there weren't any other old-time fiddle bands. Yeah. We could just do whatever we wanted to. Nobody else was going to get up and do the tunes we did. So it wasn't as tricky. You know, like I would never want to play Red Apple Rag on the same program any time that another fiddler around here was going to do that tune. I try to pick and choose.
An example of not knowing what the audience is going to like. I mean, you know, like, well, mentioned the World's Fair. We were there for 6 days, you know, and we performed twice a day, 45 minutes each time. And so, but you could do the same program because you didn't have the same people, you know, so it wasn't that big a thing. But still, because people were moving all the time, you wanted to play something that would attract their attention. And so we would play fiddle tunes and we'd do, I'd do ballads and so forth, you know, but we'd try to do things that we'd think would interest them. But I didn't do anything a cappella because it just didn't seem to be the proper place to do it. And so we stayed at one house and we had a breakfast at another house and we were all down there having breakfast one morning and we got talking about the festival and our festival and the type of things we do. And mentioned, you know, that we did a cappella things and they were wondering about them. And I don't know if you know Judy and Howard Sachs. They're from over Kenyon College. And they were with the National Folk Festival people, you know. And anyhow, they were the MC, they were the presenters, they called for us. And Judy, you know, said, well, sing one of them for us and let's hear it, you know, see how it goes. And I did a version of Barbara Allen, an old mountain version that, you know, that acapella, not the usual one you hear. And So our last performance over there, she kind of liked it, you know, and so she was out, and we were standing there wondering what to do next, you know, and she hollered and said, Andy, won't you do that song you did this morning? Said, I'd love to hear that again. So I did that, and while I was doing it, everybody that came up the hill, it was on Saturday, and it was just tons of people. They all crowded in there and sat down. They gathered out, and they stayed for the rest of the whole thing. That one song drew them all in, the very thing that we thought would not go.
I'll go home and learn Barbara Allen.
Well, I wouldn't have dreamed of that one attracting anybody, and that was the one that held them there.
That is an amazing thing. You can't second guess an audience. That's about the last thing I'm going to try to do.
Well, I thought these people would all be in such a, you know, going trying to see everything, you know, and that was the way it was all week. But they weren't in any hurry then. They stayed for the rest of the thing. So, but they'd been going by before that.
Huh. You know. That is interesting. They heard something
different. It was different from what they'd been hearing. That's what it was.
What did you play when you went to Alaska?
Same thing we played when we went to Washington.
See,
one of the good things about folk music. You don't have to learn a lot of new things.
You can keep... My uncle plays fiddle, and he says he plays for his own amazement.
Yeah. Well, we did a couple of concerts. Actually, we didn't have to play all that long, so just our usual things, you know, that we did.
Where were you?
In the Alaska State Museum.
a living artifact.
Stayed with the assistant curator and his wife. They even gave us a car to sightsee in.
Yeah.
What was
the occasion?
It was the Alaska Folk Festival. That's where they had it.
Are you representing Kentucky or
no? Actually, Merle Travis was supposed to be there and he couldn't make it, so they called us.
Well, hey.
And we went. I don't actually when they called. I mean, it was just out of the clear. See, every place that we have played, we have never asked to play the first place that we at any time. It's either people have called us or written letters. We've never solicited a job at any time. And people don't believe that, these other musicians. That they don't know how we get to these various places. And to be honest, I don't either. You know, and so when we got a call from Alaska, they had heard us on public radio and decided they wanted to see if we would be interested in coming.
How did you get your music? How did it come to be that it was on National Public Radio?
Well, it is from time to time, even on TV. I've never seen any of it.
People tell you, huh?
Yeah, my cousin lived in Chicago, said he was flipping the channels one night, and there I was. And another friend saw us in New Orleans. And we were in the Holiday Inn magazine. A friend was in Texas and saw it in the magazine. And my daughter and... her husband stayed at a motel in Hamilton, or Ohio, or someplace. I believe it's where they were. He's a band director for the high school, and they'd gone for something. And she said he was looking through the magazine. And he said, Michelle, said your mother and daddy's looking at us. She said, what? So he showed her the magazine, and, you know, had our picture there.
You have that in your
box? Yeah,
that'll be fun. Yeah. How many times have you gone to El Paso?
Just once.
Just the international?
A couple of years ago, yeah.
Folk festival.
Border festival.
Boy, that's an out-of-the-way place to get to. We lived in Central Texas, and the idea of... We saw that festival, and we saw a list of people that were going to be there, and we wanted to go. But do you realize what we'd have to do to get there? It's a 13-hour drive. We were an hour, 2 hours east of Austin.
Didn't take us that long to go.
No. So they had a variety of music there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they... I have the brochure that has everything in it. You want to see one?
I sure do.
Now?
I'm not there.
Mm-hmm. I've got several.
That's where you met Allie Bain.
Yeah, we met him there. We'd known him before.
You know him before.
Oh, yeah, because have you heard of Betty Smith?
Uh-huh.
Well, she and her husband were in Scotland. And when we saw him later, he said, Bill, you know, he said, J.P. said, I thought I heard you in Scotland. Said that we were walking down the street and started in a pub. They were going in a pub. And I said, we heard Wild Rose of the Mountain. Yeah, that's the tune J.P. plays. That's his one he's known for.
Oh, it's his signature tune when y'all do it.
And he said, it sounded just like you playing it. And he said, so, said we went in. Said, and it wasn't you, you know. And said, we got to talking to him. He didn't know then it was Allie Bain at that time. And it was Allie Bain. He asked him where he'd heard it. And he said, well, he learned it off of an album by a fiddler named J.P. Frey. So Bill was telling us about that. And then later, National Mine Service, J.P. works for, a Scottish company, bought National Mine, or the controlling shares, you know. And they called out here and told J.P. to bring his album in, that the fella, Howard Glasby, was a fiddle fan. He liked fiddles, and for him bring an album in there. So he went in, they introduced him, you know, and he took the album. He said that he was close friends with a fiddler in Scotland that he liked real well. It was Allie Bain. So when he went back to Scotland, he sent us a couple of Allie Bain's albums. So, of course, you know, J.P., hearing about Allie Bain all this time when we went to El Paso, well, when we got the brochure with everything in, you know, I said, guess who else is going to be here? And he said it. I said, Allie Bain. He said, Allie Bain. He was so excited.
Oh, it was like a homecoming to someone you didn't even know.
Then they ended up in workshop together and jammed a lot and everything. And then last summer, a fellow from Scotland called from Scotland and asked if we'd be interested in doing a film that Allie Bain would be narrating. And he called back a second time. I'm sure J.P. would want to do it, and he called back a second time, you know, and well, actually about three times to make arrangements. And so we went up last fall to Gene Ritchie's house, and Allie Bain and Mike Seeger and Elizabeth Cotton, Gene Ritchie, and we did J.P. and Allie Bain twin fiddled on Wild Rose of the Mountain for the film. So, and I played guitar behind Allie Bain.
Hey. those are the heavies of traditional music. The names you just ran down, that's it.
We picked up Elizabeth Cotton and Hazard, got her over at the hotel, and I drove her over. And was going up this hall at Gene Rich's, you know, and the mountains come right down and all this. She was saying, I don't know what they wanted me here for. Do you know who Elizabeth Cotton is? She's 92 years old.
I was going to ask you.
She wrote Freight Train, which is a real good traditional tune.
That's a marvelous story. Yes. Charles Seeger was doing a lot of collecting and writing articles for the Folklore Journal, and he was scouring the mountains, scouring everywhere, looking for people who knew ballads and would sing for him. Elizabeth Cotton was their housekeeper.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't know for how long. You probably know this story better than I did.
They call her Libba. Well, she told it. She told me about it.
What did she say?
She said they call her Libba because that Mike's sister, or what her name was, couldn't say Elizabeth when she was small, and she called her Libba. And so when you hear anybody that's real close to her talking to her, they call her Libba. And, well, that was, she told me that much of it. And anyhow, Mike started taking her here and there to sing. And she plays guitar. She plays left-handed, I think.
Yeah, I think she does.
And plays banjo and sings. And what she was saying as we was going up there, you know, I don't know what. She likes cities. She's from Syracuse, New York right now, but she was born in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Said she never went back there anymore because it wasn't in the family. And so she never went back there, and she liked the cities anyhow. And she'd say, I don't know why they brought me here. Said, why, these hills just might topple over us, and them big trees, they just might fall on us. Well, I was amazed at where Gene Ritchie's house was. I had heard about this house she was building. I don't know how many times people talk about her house. Well, we went up this hollow, and we parked in her sister's yard. And it was just a little narrow place, and you could see her house up here on the hill, but it looked like there wasn't even room enough to put that house. And just a gravel, I mean a rutted road that went up to it that you couldn't drive up. Well, some of them did, but it was dangerous. And so we had to park down here, and Mike Seeger walked up and got a Jeep to come back down to get Elizabeth Cotton. And there was just the seat in the front, and you know, and just everything piled in the back. She was not going to let me walk. She was going to crawl over in that back rather than for me to walk up there. Well, I walked. He had to drive real slow, and I walked right behind him. And when they stopped, well, I was standing right there beside him. And she looked around, and she jumped. She said, "How did you get there?" We had more fun with her, I tell you. She just kept on going on. You know, how in the world did I get there?
She can get help.
It seemed to be. She laid down and took a little nap, or not nap. She just stretched out. It was extremely hot. I know it was 103 degrees, and she made it though, and she done real well on her. You wouldn't believe at that age at how limber her fingers still are.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it just sounded like a young person playing. She's really a.
So she's on the film too.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually started in Nashville with Bill Monroe.
Uh-huh.
It was a film tracing the music back to Scotland, starting with the.
Huh, that's an interesting mm-hmm. perspective, isn't it?
Yeah. And in fact, Ali Bain called in March. He was up in Charleston, and he called and said it was. We wanted to go up and see him, but we had to play out Carter Case the same night he was up there. But he called Saturday morning and mentioned that the film was going real well over there. It's a television film. So we were just on a little bit, but at least we were on two tunes, I think.
Yeah. What did you play? How did you go about deciding what to play? I mean, here is a situation where you have lots of things that you can pick from, and you've got to play two.
Well, I think...
And the Scottish, I mean, that's a different audience.
Yeah. J.P. and I played Dusty Miller, and then him and Allie played Wild Roses Mountain.
You know, I've always, when anybody says Dusty Miller, what comes to my mind is somebody milling a grain and being dusty.
Yeah.
I was going to Seeds the other day, and there's a little gray plant.
There's a plant, yeah. It's not the flower, though. It's the miller.
I wondered about that.
That's what I used to think in the beginning. I thought it was about the Dusty Miller.
It was about the Dusty Miller, too. Well, a little plant.
Don't you imagine that plant got that name because it looks like it's had flowers spilled on it?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's all white looking.
Yeah. Oh, I see. Yeah. That's better.
Mm-hmm. I imagine it.
Well, anyway, I bought the plant because it had a fiddle tune. We know this old fiddle tune called Betty Likens. It's a modal sounding tune we learned off of an album. And this woman, just out of the blue, she was in the audience. She came up and she was asking us if we would go somewhere and play for a program that she was having. I said, "Well, what is your name?" And she said, "Betty Likens." She got the biggest reaction out of me. She had no idea she was carrying around in her own name a fiddle tune.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Have you played, I know you played at Brandywine Festival. Is that, the name?
Mm-hmm, Brandywine.
The album that I ran across, you were on... that must have been the third or fourth year that they had it. You went back this past year?
Not this past year, year before last.
You have another album that they made from that?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Did you look back to see what you played the first time?
No, really. I never even thought about it.
What's your favorite situation to play?
I don't like formal stages. I like informality. I don't like where you can't see anybody for the footlights. I want to see people.
Mm-hmm.
It makes me nervous not to see them. I'm afraid they're going to throw things.
When someone is introducing you to an audience, what are some of the best things that the person that has that job to do, to get up and introduce you and JP are getting ready to come on stage? What are some of the best things that kind of introducer can do or say that helps you do your good job.
Well, to be honest, I seldom listen to what they're saying. I'm always being sure that JP's there. I've had several instances where he showed up at the last minute and I just hear him say our name and I have no idea what they said. And I have gone out and said something that I got to wonder, did they really, you know, said something about what they said, and then I got to wonder, now is that what they really said, you know, and because I was just half listening. So just ever what they say is all right with me. So we get out there and play and get it over with and get back off and pick up the check.
We all want that, don't we?
In the instances where there is one, there's a lot of instances where there isn't, but
you have done a lot of work organizing your festival, and you're working with the Gene Thomas Revival. Is that what it's going to be called?
Well, the singing gathering, so it will be a revival of the American Folk Song Festival.
Uh-huh.
Hopefully.
I wish you'd give me a list of do's and don'ts, because I'm having to learn the hard way what is going to work. And, of course, you know, coordinating through a larger organization
is
different than running the show yourself. And I'm not in a situation where I'm running the show.
Yeah, well, now, see, that's the thing that would be hard for me. I started, like with Miss Thomas. There was times that just she and I worked together, and then she had a little committee where people were doing things. It just didn't work for us, and it didn't for her. It doesn't for me. I don't know if I'm not saying. Well, then there was this other festival that came around where they had a committee, and everybody has different ideas, and it didn't last long. 3 or 4 years, 4 or 5. And then when Sybil Clark was out there, you know, she had me to come out and be in on this, helping to get things together. Well, I cannot do that. I sit there. I don't suggest, I don't do anything. Because I feel really inferior to all these people. And I feel like everybody has better ideas than I do, or that they can do it better. But at the same time, I can see what they're doing wrong. Now, that doesn't make too much sense, but I just can't work with anybody that way. But because of that inferior feeling, but when I know I have to do it myself, I can do it. I mean, if I don't have to, if I can say, you do this and you do that and so forth, or if I just do it all, well, see, when we started ours, I thought JP was going to help me. I mean, we were going to do
that's an easy assumption to make.
For 3 or 4 years, all I did was cry because I couldn't get him to do anything. And all this time expecting it, you know, and all, disappointment continually. Mm-hmm. I remember once that it is a tiresome thing.
Oh, it's a tedious job.
Well, see, I do all the emceeing. This is Friday night, Saturday night, and Sunday. All day Saturday and Saturday night and Sunday. I do all the MC, I do all the sound work, I do all getting everybody up there, I do everything, you know, besides getting it all together in the first place. And so I asked him one Sunday evening if he would, I said, you know, JP, I just can't go another minute, you know, can't you just finish out? I had the names listed down, who was going to play, can't you just introduce these people? Well, I guess I can. Well, he had quit smoking for 10 years, and I knew that he had started back, but he was slipping around away from me, you see.
We all do that, don't we?
And anyhow, when he said, well, he said, I'll do it just as soon as I get through playing. He'd get it with every different groups and play with them. He said, as soon as I get through playing with them. Well, so he went out and played, and I went up and sat down in the car. It was kind of up on the hill. It was at the Cascade area, Carter Caves then. And I saw him come out when he got through playing and went right up on the hill behind him. Didn't even bother to introduce the next ones that's coming out. It was Pauline Allen. She just went out and introduced herself. Thank goodness she'd been on radio with us some, so she could do it easy enough. You know, see, we had a lot of people never been on stage before. You know, I mean, I like to get people that haven't performed in front of people or whatever. And at that time, we had a lot of them. And well, I just followed him up on the stage when I saw she'd got up on the hill. And when I got there, he was just lighting up, you know. I said, well, you won't have to be like a little boy and hide around anymore now, will you? I said, I just want to tell you, I'm through. I've quit. I'm not doing anymore. I went down gym day, and some of them was over in the hall of there practicing. I just said, Jim, you all go on next. So I know that they were going to be ready. And I went on up and sat on him. JP come down. You could tell, oh, he was so mad. And he was looking all around for me. I just sat down in the car like that. Well, he went on, and he introduced everyone. But, and there was only two or three yaks left, you know. But he was so mad. And Andy Merritt, a boy from Cleveland, that came down every year. Well, he was getting ready to go home, and he came up to the car, saw me sitting up there, and he said, I was getting ready to leave Annadine. He said, and I just wanted to tell you how much admiration I had for somebody that could pull something together like this and do such a good job. And I just burst out crying. That good, kind words.
That was what you needed to do.
And that boy didn't know what he had said.